Test.
Yep.
1, 2.
House Hess Committee is called to order.
Broken.
And it is about 3:22 and on April 1st, 2004. And we have quite a few bills to go over today. So we're going to hear five bills. One of the sponsors pulled a bill. It was, we are not going to, if there's anybody online or anybody for House Bill 239, ID system for prescriptions, the sponsors pulled that till the next meeting, so we will not be hearing that bill today. We are going to hear House Bill 425, House Bill 239, House Bill 72, and House Bill 543 if we have time, so we might not. So first of all, we're going to hear House Bill 425, Secondary Boarding Schools. This puts into statute the Department of Education's current practice regarding secondary boarding schools. This bill is sponsored by Representative Coghill. It was recently heard in the Education Committee, and Representative Coghill, do you want to stay where you're at, or do you want to go?
I just want to sit here, Madam Chair.
All right.
Since there's no camera.
Oh, you know what? I'm sorry. First of all, I'd let the record reflect that Representative Seaton, Representative Coghill, Representative Wolf, and Representative Gatto, and myself, Wilson, are pregnant, so we do have a quorum.
A what?
I don't think we're pregnant.
Pregnant?
Present.
But you said pregnant. That's a miracle. Arnold Schwarzenegger. I got you beat.
It's been a long day, I guess. You forgot to mention that we're here. Okay.
Congratulations.
It was April.
Oh, yeah.
It's April Fool's Day. It's all right.
And we are going to hear House Bill 427, too. My efficient staff let me know I skipped one of them. So, okay, Representative Coghill, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thanks for letting me have House Bill 425 before the committee. Boarding schools in Alaska have sometimes created some pain, but they've also created some gain. I think the one in your district, in Sitka, Mount Edgecombe, has been a very valuable asset to Alaska. And because of trying to get students to areas where they can get education and be boarded, Alaska has agreed that if a student can't get education in a certain district, that they would get a stipend and air travel to and from a place so they can get an education. And this bill, 425, expands that to say that they may go ahead and travel to a boarding school even if in their school district they actually do have the possibility of getting it, getting an education in 9 through 12. So with that expansion, there comes a cost. And so in a way to contain the cost, what I tried to do was to limit the boarding schools to those presently doing it. There is a variety of different boarding schools, and they all have a variety of different programs. I also put a sunset limit on the provision. It actually repeals the provision and has to be reinstated. If you look at the date that we have, it's 2009. So let me make sure I get the bill here, make sure I'm not misquoting myself. Also, it requires that it be for those who are operating a full year boarding school, 180-day class. It will cost some money, but Madam Chair, what I'd like to do is draw the attention to the fiscal note. There has been a change in the fiscal note, and the latest one, the bottom right hand, dated 3/10/2004, shows that the cost would be about $1,179,000 to operate the boarding schools that are presently doing it. That is a saving of about $227,000 from how we first originally figured it. The stipend and the education itself is a flexibility that I think Alaska needs. The boarding schools have done, I think, an excellent job in a variety of different areas. The one that I'm particularly interested in is the one in my hometown, Nenana. There has been some economic reasons for doing it. They had a larger school with a dwindling population. So I think this is one reason they wanted to use their school. But they've also come to the table with some significant capital. I think they're a home rule city, first class city, that actually does education funding through the city. They went out and got some loans and built a building and invited people in and are now presently doing it. And in one of the graphs here, it shows how many students they have. I'll get to that in just a second. But be that as it may, the hold harmless is the next major provision that I think that we should probably talk about. There are some school districts that if they have students going to school in the 9 through 12 and fall under the 10-person minimum for students, actually have to close up shop and go away. The state won't fund them at that level. And this bill is saying that if they go to a boarding school that causes that floor to happen, that they would be held harmless on that the student count. And there's a reason for that. There are some smaller schools that I just envision the possibility of, say, somebody in. I know one school in trouble is probably Circle, if I remember correctly, that may fall out of the floor. In fact, they may have already done that this year. I don't know. But if that student wanted to get, say, a higher math class or take on a trade that couldn't be given there and wanted to go to Galena or Nenana, that they could do that and it would not kick that school out in, if it was just for that one student. And I might have the department help me explain that a little better. This is just a way of providing for those who struggle with where they're being educated at. There are many in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau that I understand go to some of these boarding schools. It also gives opportunity for those in bush communities that are struggling with either family issues, social issues, a whole range of things that might be troubling them socially. But it also deals kind of academically with a variety of things that could be offered. I think Galena has done a good job of offering a variety of different things. Nenana specifically probably goes to more the cultural aspects. Galena looks probably more to the trade school things. And I think that's also true with Mount Edgecombe, if I remember correctly. They deal with some academics that you can't get in other places in rural Alaska. So I'd like to get this up to finance because I think it's a little bit of a hurdle, but I think it's a judgment call we've already made as a state. I'm just expanding it to those that have already set up shop, as you will, and then limiting it to the time allowed to see if this really is, in fact, cost-effective. So with that, what I do is try to answer questions, and I lean very heavily on the department for any of the technical questions. I will tell you this, of the schools that are doing it, they all have variations of people that they accept. Some of it is because of geographical issues. Some of it is because there's a waiting list and they have to go through kind of a system of, are you going to be able to stay there, the family support, those types of things. And as far as the other things, I would really depend on those people to tell us what those intake criteria are. But I think there are a variety of different intake criteria. At this point, this would give them the ability to apply. So.
Before we proceed, let the record show that Representative Cisna and Representative Mary Kapsner are I'm so used to calling her Mary, that they have joined us. I have a question that I'm not sure that I understand totally. The hold harmless section, it says it allows a student's district of residence to count a student for ADM count even though the student is attending a secondary boarding school. This avoids the possibility of paying the base allocation twice. So are you saying that the board, the boarding school doesn't count them, but the school they came from does?
Madam Chair, maybe I should have the department step forward and share how that is going to be divided up.
Eddie, why don't you state your name and explain that to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the school finance manager for the Department of Education and Early Development. The hold harmless provision simply states that if you're in a community that has a small school population of, say, 11 or 12 students, and a couple of those students elect to go to a boarding school, and that school falls below the state's threshold of 10, we would hold that school harmless and fund them for the 10 students. You may remember in our previous committee, we talked about that, and that there's a range of 10 to 20 students that we provide a base level of funding for. So all that does is really extend that range from 20 to 10 down to 20 to 9 or 8, depending on what the circumstance is if a child, secondary child in a community elects to go to one of these regional boarding schools.
So I understand that part of it, because you don't want to have that school closed, so they get to count. Okay, but when the state starts funding then, does that student's funding follow, stay in the school where they were? And of course, because there's a certain amount for those smaller schools, does the boarding school get to count them, and do we pay the boarding school then?
Madam Chair, we would be paying the boarding school for that child attending there, both through the foundation program and through this boarding stipend to cover the residential component. Basically, all we're doing is extending that base down a couple students for the community that has a small student population. So I wouldn't say we're really paying for the child twice. What we're doing is extending a safety net for that community that has a very small student population. And because a child has elected to go to another community, a secondary child to another community, to one of these other programs that's offering a more diverse program, we're just holding them harmless for that instance.
But what I'm asking, that will that make a difference if we, I'm just trying to
Madam
figure
Chair,
out, are we paying twice,
as it,
really?
Madam Chair, we would not be paying twice unless you speculate that kid goes away, the enrollment falls to 9 or 8 students. In that case, we would not fund that school as a separate school. They would be added to the largest school in the district, which at that point it becomes inefficient for a district to operate, and they would probably close that school. So I guess I don't see it as funding the child twice. It's just holding that school harmless while that secondary student goes to a different program.
Okay, now if the numbers were 15 students and 2 of them left,
there's no change
there's no
in the
change.
Funding level for that school.
Okay, that's what I was trying to get. I wanted to make sure that was on the record.
But they wouldn't qualify for the hold harmless either. And they would still be within our range of 10 to 20 students.
Representative Sisson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I actually had thought that the question I wanted to ask would be after this. But now that I'm listening to this and realizing that it may be that a few critical students that it's decided that the few critical students that would actually allow for a school to stay open might create the situation where the school would be closed because it goes down below the critical mass. You suddenly are back in the same situation we were before Molly Hooch. And if I got the right name for the right thing, yeah. And I actually, and it would seem that my neighbor to the right, Representative Katzner, would be the person who would be the most qualified to talk about this. But the fact of the matter is, I was at one of those discussions about Molly Hooch up in Minto back in the early 70s, and was working with some of the kids in therapeutic care who had been through the boarding school situations, and part of the population that even created that whole lawsuit. And the boarding situations, those there were a number of them, and the horrifying things that happened to kids because they were taken away from homes before they were really ready. Some of the kids would be ready. That's absolutely true. We have some leaders that have come out of kids that were ready to go, and they did. But there are a lot of kids that are dead now that never got to adulthood because of those programs. My question is, how do we make sure that this kind of thing doesn't lead to the whole horrifying, you know what I mean? I mean, that was just a horrible period in Alaskan life.
Representative, I think that'd probably be more appropriate for me to answer than the department at this point.
Okay.
That's why I started off saying boarding schools has had kind of an interesting history in Alaska. Those were pretty much mandated.
Mm-hmm.
They were run at a whole different fashion. This is permissive. This is something that people actually apply to go to. There's usually a lot of parental support. There's a demonstrated need. There's a willingness to help with personal, cultural, and economic issues that probably was not as sensitive in the days of the earlier boarding schools. So I would say there's really two totally different approaches. Those people who want to go to a boarding home really have to stand in line to do that right now. So, and that's one of the reasons why I put a limit on it. Wasn't because I want to limit boarding schools so much, but our ability to pay, number one, is going to be stretched. And I want to see how the ones that are doing now might align, because they're still pretty new in some of the growth. Part of the difference is some of them are aligned with cyber school issues, and I want to see how that's going to work out. Both Galena and Ninana have distance education cyber schools, and you know, and it's very dynamic. So I'm just watching to see how that turns out. But I don't want the boarding school element itself to go away. I think that's a good system. It's appropriate. And until we have other kinds of economy built in some of the other areas of the state, while we're going through cultural changes in the state of Alaska, I just think this is one good avenue. This is not certainly a fix-all. In fact, they're so small in number. We think we have about 134,000 students in Alaska, and this is probably going to take care of somewhere in the neighborhood 200 to 300 students. So it's a very small segment of our society, but I have found through personal testimonies it's been good for those families and those individuals, and they want to do it.
Eddie, I think, has a comment that was, so if you'd
okay, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make it really clear to the committee that none of the students in these programs are being required to leave their home and go to these programs. And these programs are currently operating. They're currently operating as a boarding school option for kids. And what this bill does is it provides those school districts with some revenue to help offset the residential cost of operating those programs. It's, like I said, it's optional for these kids and their families. And what the Hold Harmless does is provides a safety net for the community in which a student may elect to participate in one of these programs. Now, as far as I know right now, nobody would even need the safety net. It hasn't affected a school that small. But I think what Representative Coghill's trying to do with this is saying, let's provide you with some revenue to help you with your residential costs of this program. And oh, by the way, we're sensitive to those very small communities that may have a couple secondary students take advantage of these programs, we don't want you to have to close your school in your small community because of that choice they made. So with the hold harmless, we're going to hold your community harmless while we take a look at how effective these programs are. And that's what this bill is all about.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Representative Gatto, you had a question?
Yes, I did. Just for clarification for myself, I'm trying to think of student A and student B. Let's say student A is in a school district that has, or in a school that has 17 students. And they're funded at a fixed rate, whether that student is there or not, correct?
Correct.
Now, that student decides to go to a boarding school in Nenana. The school suffers no loss. That's the whole harmless portion. And indeed, this bill supplies money for the boarding school. What about the money? Does the student-based allocation follow the student in addition, because he is now a member of a school district or in a new school district?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, that's currently happening right now. And the money does not, the money goes to the new school that the child's enrolled in. So, for example, Nenana is serving 96 students that don't reside in Nenana. They're currently generating funding for those kids through the foundation program. Some of them may come from a community that falls within that range of 10 to 20. Some may come from Fairbanks, would have typically gone to a high school in Fairbanks. The point is these programs are up and operating. We are providing foundation funding for those kids' educational component of their program. What the state is not providing right now is support for the residential side of the program. And that's what this bill does. It simply provides some residential support.
Just for one, for one additional clarification, the student leaves Fairbanks, then Fairbanks does lose the student base allocation for that student because he's no longer there. He's now in Nenana. Am I correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, you're correct. In that scenario, that would be correct.
We do have, if we don't have any more questions right now, we'll go online, off net first. We have two people. Floyd Brooks, are you online, Floyd?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, state your name and your affiliation.
My name is Floyd Brooks. I have three girls that are in the clinic. I'm a single parent. And it's given me an opportunity to seek employment that was not available to me where I live. And what's more important to me than anything is that it's been a safe place for my girls to live and work. I feel there's a lot of benefit.
Lloyd, I have a question for you. So now, what village do you live in?
Say again?
What village do you live in?
I happen to live in Enana.
Okay, and so now, are you working in Enana or are you working somewhere else?
No, I just got done work on a job in Fort Yukon, but I've worked in Fairbanks and in Anchorage.
So when's
given me a safe place for my my pitch to be.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else have any questions? Okay, Sandra Eggleston? Eggleston?
Yes, this is Sandra Eggleston.
Go ahead, Sandra.
Resolved and friendships prevailed that they're in.
Sandra, would you send your, you said you had written notes. If you have, if you can you fax them to us so that we can have them for the record?
Yes, I would be glad to do that.
Thank you.
And do you want to give me that fax number, or do I call someone else?
Well, it's 465-2646.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next is R. Lindquist. I don't know if that's a male or a female. It just has an R, so.
Can you hear me? It must be me.
Yep, one must be.
Okay. My name is Ralph Lindquist, and I am a senior student at the International Learning Center. And those of you that I've met with down in Judo, I wanted to greet you, and thank you for your effort. I just wanted to echo something that Andy Jean said, that this is, we are not the same kind of boarding school that was in place 30 to 40 years ago. This is definitely an option. We do not go to the villages and shake the trees and have try to drum up business. People are finding us. Evidently, the proof of the pudding is in the taste. The kids that we have here this year that are eligible to come back, 80% of those kids have already re-enrolled for next year. March 31st is our deadline, and we will be sending out acceptance letters sometime in April, 1st of April. We have about 200 applicants on file now, and we're going to have to pick and choose 75 of those kids because that's all we have room for. It would be a shame to not only tell 125 kids we don't have a place, it would just be terrible to tell those 75 kids that we are planning on that we don't have room for them either because of finances. On the first quarter and the third quarter, when the kids in town are having parent-teacher conferences, we send out six teams to the villages, and we just had a team come back just yesterday from Mountain Village and from St. Mary's, and it's scary, the number of requests that they have. It's just as our demand keeps going up, our supply keeps going down. We don't ever plan on being bigger than 100 in Enana. That's the wishes of the town in Enana. But I just want to tell you that the demand for the product that we're offering is incredible. The other thing that I know time is important. The other thing is that on the bill that Representative Caulfield has proposed, he has us down for 100 kids. We will have room for 75 next year. That will generate about $4,450 per student if this bill goes through the way it is written. With 75 kids, that gives us about $338,000, which I think is probably less than the top dollar amount that the bill is looking at. As Sandy Engelson said, the first year, 01-02, we received zero state funding for operations of the Living Center. For 02-03, we received zero money from the state for operating the Living Center. Last year, through the governor and the legislature, we received a one-time grant of $500,000, which we appreciate so very much. And then if this bill passes, we will get roughly $338,000. That big bang for the buck. Senator Wilkin had published a report that's entitled K-12 Public Education School Operating Fund, and that taking those monies that are reflected in that report, if our kids, if our 75 kids had stayed home this year, it would have cost the state an additional $350,000 in local ABM money. Eddie could probably address that, the veracity of that statement. But for our part in this bill is we are providing an excellent product that students and parents are coming back for more, actually doing it for less money than what it would cost if those kids stayed in their home village. And if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Mr. Lindquist, I have a question for you. So what you're saying is that your town built the building for the boarding school, and then you just hoped that the money would follow.
That's my understanding. I wasn't here when that happened. I think that they had other plans of revenue sources that just didn't pan out. I think Representative Coghill might be privy to more information than I am on that. I came into it
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Elle Brooks?
Hi, my name is Leah Brooks. I'm a junior attending the Genetics and Women's Center, along with my two sisters. First, I'd like to thank you for supporting me the opportunity to address my testimony for Hospital 425.
You're welcome.
There's a lot of things. I came to the Living Center because I originally lived in Indiana, and it gave me an opportunity to up my grades, and so far I'm an honor student, which I have never been before at the Living Center. They have great kids. The staff members here really do care about us, and it's really important, I think, to have such a great surrounding. Some of you know me. I met with some of you when I went with Ralph and Krista Kenningston to meet with you guys down in Juneau. And I just, there's a lot of things here that keep us busy. I'm a part of the snowboarding club. And there's classes here that they offer us, such as, I don't know, my dad, he is going to be teaching a beading class. Rustic surgery class, which is really interesting, that really keeps a lot of the kids interested and keep their minds set for better opportunities. There's also an EMT class and a construction class and a culinary arts class, which opens better horizons for the future. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Lisa, do you live at home or do you live at the boarding school?
No, I live at the Living Center.
Okay, but you live there in Indiana.
Before I came to the Living Center, I did live in Indiana, but there was a choice for me because my dad went to go work for econ, and I had the choice between going for econ or staying in Indiana, and the opportunity to stay in Indiana was the Living Center, and I chose the Living Center because they have more opportunities for me here than I would have had in Fort Yukon.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
John Grimes?
Yes, I'm John Grimes. My wife and I came up to Alaska in 1994 from Dallas, Texas. We came up with six kids, and we, for whatever reasons, wound up in Indiana. With the exception of a year and a half up on the North Slope, we have spent the whole time in Indiana. And the opportunity came up here. They had been discussing the boarding school in the guys that are here from there are incredible. The what my wife and I bring to the table here is we have raised, of course, our seven kids. We have one left at home, Nathaniel. And we just work with the guys. We just let them know that there's other places. There's a bigger horizon there than just the village. And they come in here scared. They come in here not knowing what they want to do in life. They come in here with no direction. And we're just there to help them, guide them, and just whatever we can do. And there is this Living Center is incredible with what it's doing to help the students in the state. And I just basically want to speak my heart and ask for your support for that HB 425. Without that, we're probably not going to be able to open the doors. And I tell you, I do not want to look at these guys here and tell them, the doors are not going to be open, you're not going to be able to come back. That's going to be probably one of the toughest hall meetings I'm ever going to have with these guys. So we love it here. We hope and pray we can spend the next however many years this thing is open here. And I thank you for your time.
How do you work that at home, John, when you have children and you guys are the parents at the dorm? Do the kids just live with you there at the dorm, or how's that work?
Well, all of our kids are grown and gone. We have Nathaniel is 10, and he lives here with us and, of course, goes to school at the Indiana City School. And he just has 17 big brothers and 40 or 50 big sisters. And as you can imagine, he has the typical little brother syndrome, where he likes to get under on the nerves of these other ones, and they put him in his place, and everything's fine. So he loves it. We love it, and I think the students love that also.
Okay, thanks, John.
Thank you very much,
Jim Smith. Are you Jim? Were you want to make comments, or were you just for questions?
Were you talking to Jim Smith?
Yep, Jim Smith.
I'm sorry, Madam Chairman. It beeped when the last name came out, so I wasn't sure whether you were addressing me or not. I certainly would be available to respond to any questions they might have about the Galena Residential School Program.
Okay. Representative Gatto has a question for you.
Hi, Jim. You're an officer at Galena Schools, aren't you?
I'm the superintendent of schools, yes.
Oh, I guess that's good. How does Galena School compare with the model we're proposing here for Nenana?
We share several programs with Nenana. Some of the funding that most schools have enjoyed has come via some federal help from Senator Stevens. Right now we are in the first year of support from an Alaska Natives grant, which is funding 5 staff members at the Galena dorm, 2 at the Nenana dorm, and 3 at Mount Eshko.
Jim, let me interrupt you for a second here.
Representative Gatto, you have a follow-up?
Yeah, this is Representative Gatto again. I was a little more curious because Galena is different. You also, you have the Galena school there, but you also have the IDEA program. And so when we have kids in a boarding school, are they in any way involved or strictly separated from it?
So actually, it's the other way around. The residential school kids are in their own program on the base. We do bus kids between our two village schools. The kids in the city school here, the bus runs in the morning, at noon, and after school, and that moves kids back and forth between the vocational programs, the different ones that are at two different sites. We have kids from the IDEA Correspondence School come and spend 2 weeks in different vocational programs. We had a pre-flight school where we had IDEA students come out and stay at the dorm and spend 2 weeks going through some of our introductory pilot training kinds of things and get an idea of interest there. We had kids that are doing the same thing in our auto mechanics program here. So the residential school actually serves them, and the kids that are in the residential program don't use the correspondence school program as such.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
We have one more, Ketzler and Marks. This might be an Anana Native Council, maybe? Are they still on? Ketzler and Marks?
Yes, we're here.
Did you want to testify?
Yes, thank you. I'm sorry, I had the phone on mute, so I didn't make any distractions. Yes, thank you for this opportunity to testify. I'm here with a council member of our tribe, and then I'm the executive director for the Indiana Native Council, and we're just pleased to have an opportunity to express our delight of having the Student Living Center in Indiana. And as most people probably know, you know, Indiana has a long history dating back to the turn of the century when the Episcopal Church had built a very large mission here that operated up until the middle 50s. And after that period of time, the community of Indiana got together again in the late 60s and began running again. A boarding home program was kind of run a little bit differently then. It was kind of run by a local church here up until about 1974, and then it was run by the housing authority out of Fairbanks up until about the late 80s. And then we had a period of time where there was really no activity. However, the committee start working together again and bringing back this particular concept because we had a beautiful school that had a lot more room for students. And so anyway, now just to move on very quickly, the tribe here has just announced here publicly in the last month or so that they the intention is to build a recreational youth education center that we're going to be breaking ground in June. And this multi-purpose facility, primarily one of the aspects of it was creating more activities for these students that come in from all over the state and have a positive environment for recreational activities, as well as after-school curricular educational activities. And and I think that's a pretty strong indication that the tribe supports the boarding home concept. And so I appreciate this opportunity to testify.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else that's going to online that would like to testify?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, my name is Anna Malcolm. I'm calling from Cal State. I'm a parent of one of the students that's in the Indiana Student Living Center. And
are you happy with the school, with what they provide your child?
Yes, I'm very pleased with the way the boarding school has operated, and as a parent, I always feel the need for education is important, and if you can't get it in rural Alaska in a village, then, that's the options you have to send your kids away, then I really am pleased with Nenana and the way their boarding school is operated. And for education, education is an important part of our lives, and I feel that my children need to be challenged in every aspect and more activities.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there anyone else online? All right, then I'm going to close a public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify in this? Thank you, Eddie. Okay, then members of the committee, Representative Adel?
I'm sorry, Eddie, I did have another question, but you can probably just give me a high sign. Just for clarification, when we talk about the student-based allocation that a student was entitled to, such as in CalTag, and we say that the money follows the student, actually, that isn't entirely true, that we use a new student-based allocation when the student is in Nenana than the one he would have gotten from the community he came from. Is that correct?
I'm sure Representative Adel, you're correct. We calculate it based on the numbers in Nenana.
And so... Thank you. And so there's actually, if I can continue, a net savings to the state when a student does transfer to this, even though there's a net cost in providing the boarding school. And in the end, I'm sure it's not a wash, but it is not certainly lopsided as it seemed that unless the student base allocation changed. I just wanted to make that clear on the record that this is simply... a savings in one regard and an expense in the other regard, and we'll see how the numbers wash out in the end.
Any other comments from the committee? I do, this is very interesting to me because at Mount Edgecombe, I mean, I've been there, been in the school, listened to the teachers and to the students, and I feel those kids get an absolutely excellent education. However, the state's funding them at like, I don't know, Eddie, could you tell us how much per student it is at Mount Edgecombe?
Madam Chair, it's a little over $14,000 for both the instructional and residential component.
Okay, so that together. So I'm, if we can prove that what other schools are doing much cheaper, I mean, we've got to look at some of these things, and so I'm just telling you that we may be setting some things in action here that we're not really thinking about. But anyway, do I hear a motion at all? Do you want to make any closing comments, Representative Coghill?
Just on that point, Madam Chair, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted it with a sunset, where we have to really take a look at it. We actually have to reauthorize this when it comes down to 2009.
Representative Capsner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 425 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
And that's version H, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, any objections? Hearing no objections, the bill is passed. Thank you, everyone. And now we're going to...
get that real business.
Where's your cheat sheet?
Was that a CA?
Okay.
Representative Capsner, did you say, when you made the motion, did you say a CS for that?
Is this a committee substitute?
Yes, it is.
Okay, then as amended, committee substitute for House Bill 425.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, just to note that it is an updated fiscal note, as I mentioned previously.
Okay, next we're going to go to House Bill 427, Protection of Persons and Property. And this bill grants... state regulatory authority over private guardians and conservators and establishes the minimum qualifications and standards. This is Representative Anderson's bill, but Brian Schein, one of his staff, is going to present the bill. So, Brian, go ahead.
For the record, Madam Chair, my name is Jim Schein, staff representative Anderson. Thank you for hearing the bill. House Bill 427 will go a long way towards preventing exploitation and mistreatment of vulnerable and incapacitated adults receiving the services of a private guardian or conservator. It was drafted with input from the Alaska State Association for Guardianship and Advocacy, also known as ASAGA, the Public Office of Public Advocacy, Adult Protective Services, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office, the Disability Law Center, and the Senior Advocacy Coalition. In Alaska, professional guardians, both private and public, and family guardians provide services to approximately 2,500 disabled, vulnerable adults. Under current law, private guardians and conservators, individuals with the responsibility to make housing, legal, and medical decisions for the disabled, infirm, mentally ill, and seniors are completely unregulated by the state. Many other states regulate their private guardians, and appropriately so. Vulnerable and incapacitated adults are easy prey for those wishing to exploit their resources. This legislation would grant state regulatory authority over private guardians and conservators and establish minimum qualifications and standards. The state oversight and standards for such a sensitive and critical job will help ensure that vulnerable and incapacitated adults receive the care they deserve. HB 427 would ensure those individuals or organizations wishing to serve as private guardians or conservators meet certain criteria and register with the state. Specifically, this legislation requires private guardians to be certified by the National Guardianship Foundation and have at least 2 years of professional experience working with clients or a degree in human services, social work, psychology, sociology, gerontology, special education, or a closely related field. HB 427 will also require guardians to have experience in financial management or a degree in accounting. Critically, this legislation prohibits private guardians from registering with the state and practicing until a state and national criminal background check has been performed. Finally, HB 427 allows the Division of Occupational Licensing to revoke a private guardian's license if he or she has been found to have abandoned, exploited, abused, or neglected his or her ward, or has become unfit due to professional incompetence. In short, through regulatory oversight and the establishment of professional and academic standards, this legislation will help ensure disabled adults are not exploited by those entrusted to manage their affairs. And we have several people in the audience today to testify. Betty Wells, who is here from the Alaska State Association for Guardianship and Advocacy. We also have Sharon Wells, who is a professional private guardian. Doug Wilver is present from the Alaska court system. And we also have a representative from AARP. And I think we have a few people online as well, Josh Fink and Jim Park from the Office of Public Advocacy. And Suzanne Armstrong, who is with the Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office. And thank you for hearing this bill. And I would defer any technical questions to those who are here to testify. I believe you should have a blank CS in front of you that we just received today, version D.
Would you like to make that motion?
Madam Chair, I'll move CS for House Bill 427, version D.
Okay, this version is before us. I will hear this.
I do have one question.
I'm gonna hear the testimony, and then we'll do questions unless you want to ask somebody as they testify from the ones online.
I'll ask them as they're online.
Madam Chair, I had version A, and I just have version D. Can we find out the difference between version D and version A first?
I was going to defer those questions to the chair, to Betty Wells, who works and has been working with the drafter on those. But I think, to my understanding, that it has taken away most of the registration requirements and placed that responsibility with the occupational licensing. But she would be able to answer.
Maybe we better. We better have Peggy come forward and get that straightened out for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to be here. In terms of what you have in front of you, and what you have a couple of days ago, the first 10 pages are the sections 500 through 590 in the draft. And it took the statutory regulations pretty much verbatim out of 500 to 590 and put them into occupational license. So the first 10 pages of the committee substitute were in the old draft. They were just back in the draft. And then in addition to doing that, it also added some new language with requirements for licensure in terms of the age of the person, education, experience, and provides for a temporary license. And those are in 8.6, 30, and 40 on page 2 of the committee substitute. So that's the major change in from the draft to the substitute.
So are we pulling them all together? Is that what we're doing?
Well, we had them in the guardianship statutes, 1326, and they moved them all out of the registration for private professional guardians. They pulled them all together and moved them over to 801, which is occupational licensing. And we were calling it registration with the state. After conferring with the people from occupational licensing, they decided that they would feel better monitoring this program by calling it a license. So it's gone from registration to license, and it's been pulled under their statutes. So that's the majority. The other language in there is primarily of clarifying current statutory language and practice, and the vital changes are in the first 10 pages of the committee substitute, which regulate private guardians. Currently, we have no regulations for private guardians at all. And we had an incident a couple of years ago that I was involved in with a private agency, and they eventually went bankrupt, and we're still dealing with the fallout from that. But that made us realize that we could no longer just say Alaska is protected. Alaska's not alone in looking at statutes and reviewing them and changing them to protect vulnerable adults. And I mean, there's just been recent news articles in the Detroit Press and out of Queens, New York, about that their systems needing widespread revisions and things. And so the draft itself was, it's been a long time coming. It's been worked on probably for the last 6 years, and I'd like to reiterate what Jim Shine said, that this was with the efforts of the Disability Law Center, the one from Carolyn Rosemary Maintridge, private professional guardians, and there's one here to testify today. The people that work in the trenches, the attorneys, the visitors, the people that went through the working with the agency that went in and out of that. So we feel that it's vital. The other language is education as to what's going on.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. May I ask just a question? Are you a guardian?
No. No, I'm sorry. I got up here to answer questions. Maybe I can explain who I am. My name is Betty Wells, and I'm a court visitor in the 3rd Judicial District of Anchorage, and I've been working in the area of an adult guardianship investigation for about 15 years.
Follow-up,
Representative Wolf.
Do you have a family member that's a guardian?
No.
Do you know anybody personally that is a guardian?
No, I don't. Personally in my family, no. I work with guardians. Okay. I'm a registered guardian with the National Guardianship Foundation through my work, and I have been a guardian through a contract basis with the Office of Public Advocacy for 4 clients at different times. But my primary job is as a court investigator.
Thank you, Betty. I think if you can step down, unless
okay,
you're.
I had some other comments, but I think that we pretty much covered them. I appreciate it, Madam Chairman, and the opportunity to speak in front of the
public. I don't want to cut you off if you're not finished.
Oh no, I had a prepared speech, but we started with the most crucial part.
Before you go,
Representative Gatto has a question.
This is about 28 pages, and the sectional is 33 parts plus more. Is there some summarizing statement that you can make that says, this bill is here, too, and then finish?
The first 10 pages of the committee substitute is new legislation that we are proposing to regulate private agencies. We have no regulations. You could have a felony conviction for embezzlement and decide that you got fired from your job and hang out a shingle tomorrow, and if you could con a judge into appointing you, you could become the guardian. There is absolutely no regulation. So the first 10 pages of this is proposed regulations that would allow the Division of Occupational Licensing to issue a license. It takes away the responsibility from the judges to say, is this person a viable person? What are their credentials? What's their background? Have they had a background check? I like this guy, so I'm going to appoint them, but the judge in the next town doesn't appoint them. It gives a standard and that's the first 10 pages. The rest of it, however many pages are left, are clarification and cleanup errors, and it may be one word in a whole paragraph that we're changing, trying to make the conservatorship statutes and the guardianship statutes match up a little bit better in priority, trying to clarify that the court on its own motion can do things. So the first 10 pages are the proposed legislation to regulate guardians, and we feel that it's essential to put trust back in the system. The Office of Public Advocacy, we have a wonderful program in Alaska, and our previous legislators should be proud, because in my work with the State Association and with the National Association, Alaska is so much further ahead than some states. I mean, we have rights, if a respondent has a petition filed, they have the right to an attorney, they have the right to a hearing, they have the right to a jury trial on the issue of incapacity. We have statutes that say the courts have to monitor individual guardianships, they have to get reports, they have to know where these people are. We have visitors, we have guardian ad litem, we have all of these things, but we don't have the regulations to do that. We have a wonderful public guardianship program, but they're overworked. And there's room for some private agencies out there, but it's not a good situation right now, and I think that with having some standards across the state, it would help.
Representative Goddard, we have another question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, again. First 10 pages obviously had to be put together by more than a person, probably a group of people. And I'm just curious to know the composition of the group that pretty much came up with what constituted good regulations.
There was a study done in 1997 called the McDowell Study, and it was funded through the Division of Senior Services in the region. Study of guardianship in Alaska, and out of that study came out of that study came six major recommendations, and so the group that's been working since 1997 has been comprised of people from the Disability Law Center in Anchorage, private attorneys, public guardians, private guardianship agencies, people from the court. Judge Elaine Andrews has sat on our committee at various times, Master Dugan, court personnel, family guardians, and believe me that we went back and forth and wrangled, and some people have dropped off and other people have come on. Yeah, but it's the people that are responsible, like adult protective services and long-term care on those before those incapacitated vulnerable adults.
Thank you.
Representative Sisson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Well, it sounds like you've done a lot. I'm wondering, you said that that Alaska's ahead of other states, and that you've been working on this. Are there states, because if you're crafting new law, sometimes it's a good idea to have some tried and true things that have already been evaluated and tested. Did you pull in anything?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay,
absolutely.
Cool.
As of right now, Washington and Arizona require that their guardians, their private professional guardians, be licensed or registered with the state and also certified by the National Guardianship Foundation. So they require both. As of January 1 of 2003, Florida requires all professional guardians to be registered. And so as those states have gotten out there, California is working right now on a state-specific certification that will go with the national certification. And those are the states that are ahead of us. looked at those things. Believe me, there are states where, in Virginia, before they passed their resolution, the sheriff was the guardian of last resort. And so Alaska is out there. There are states that don't afford respondents' rights of having an attorney or having a court here. You can wake up from a coma and have a guardian. So Alaska is way out there in some of the recommendations that have been made nationally for us to do. But this is a component that we feel is really important.
Okay. Thank you, Betty. I think we're going to go off net now and talk to a Mr. or Mrs. Fink. Are you online?
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. This is Josh Fink. I'm the Director of the Office of Public Advocacy. I'm also here with Jim Parker, who is my supervisor of the Public Guardian Section. I primarily wanted to be available for questions, but I just have a few brief comments. I know that you have some others there that would like to testify. And again, I'm available for any technical questions on the bill. I think this bill is critical in that we need to regulate the professional industry that has such immense power and control over vulnerable and incapacitated adults. You know, we regulate hairdressers. We don't regulate people that make decisions about people's medical care or housing or legal decisions. And we have had a situation a number of years ago that was referred to where a private guardian ended up going bankrupt, and we are still dealing with that. We also need to ensure the integrity of this industry with the public and the courts. Right now, OPA is a public guardian, or the guardian of last resort. You're supposed to first look to family, private organization before you come to OPA. But increasingly, the courts, we're finding, don't have any level of confidence in public guardians or private guardians out there. So OPA is getting appointed more and more in situations that I think would be appropriate for private guardians if the confidence level was there. As a side note, as a new director here at OPA, one of the things I'd like to do is to encourage the development of private guardians and conservators. To the extent the private sector can cover that for us, I think it's better the private sector be doing it than a government agency. I don't think we're going to see this industry develop here or the level of confidence in the private sector's integrity rise until we have some state regulation. A number of people have been involved in this legislation. We're very thankful that Representative Anderson introduced it and provided staff to shine to work it. Both Betty and Jim have indicated the groups involved in preparing the legislation. Don't know if anybody opposed to it, though we may discover that, but I think we've touched all concerned entities or interested entities about the legislation and worked out something I think everybody agrees is a good bill. One of the representatives asked earlier to finish a sentence. This bill is needed. Why, in a single sentence, is needed? Because we need to regulate people that are controlling very important personal and private decisions of vulnerable adults. And we just don't have that in place now. And so with those comments, I will be available for any questions, Madam Chairwoman. Thank you.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have one other person there with you? Are either one of you guardians, or do you know of any person that's, personal friend or a member of your family that's a guardian?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto?
Wolf.
My apologies. Well, of course, I have a number of public guardians in the agency. I'm sitting right now with Jim Parker, who's the supervisor of my public guardian section, and I've got Steve Young, who is my lead public guardian. Of course, we're not private guardians. We're for state agencies. Private guardians, yes, I am acquainted with an individual up in Fairbanks, the PGRB, who does private guardianship work. And I've met a private guardian who I believe is there in the committee room who are working on this legislation.
Well, I work Representative Wolf.
So this Representative Wolf again. So they've actually gone through the hearing and the questions have been posed to them concerning being the guardian for an individual that is not capable of taking care of themselves.
Through the chair, Representative Wolf, I will say that Sharon Wells was instrumental in crafting this legislation. My public guardians, including Steve Young,
Thank you. Representative Seaton has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. On page 16 of the new draft, we're talking about when appointing a relative or friend for the incapacitated person as a guardian. I don't know if you have that in front of you, so I'll read it. As a guardian of an incapacitated person, the court shall require that the proposed guardian complete a one-hour mandatory education on the basis of guardianship before appointment or within 30 days after the appointment. Is that one-hour course? Is that a formal course? Does that exist now? Or is this a requirement that we will formulate after the passage of this legislation?
Through the Chair, Representative, currently the Office of Public Advocacy has a public guardian who provides training to families on how to provide guardianship services, and we make that person available to communities. If there's a number of people, we'll go out and put on a class. We also have a book with videos and written material we've put in libraries, and we're distributing to the courthouses currently, and again, this individual is available to provide that training when necessary. So this isn't something that needs to be created. We currently have this course, and we just make ourselves available to provide that.
Thank you.
Mary Capson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hey, Josh, this is Mary. I just have a couple questions for you, and a short answer is fine. Are any faith-based groups doing this kind of work?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay, the other thing I was wondering, just because I don't know how this process works, are the guardian ad litems for adults with disabilities pretty much the same as guardian ad litems for China cases? Are they different?
Through the Chair, Representative Casper, they're different. Guardian ad litem in a child's case is representing they're similar and different. Guardian ad litem in a child's case represents the best interest of a child in a child needed aid proceeding. And then, of course, hopefully when that resolves, the guardian ad litem is no longer involved. With an adult who has a public or private guardian, typically, you'll have guardianship for a limited period of time during disability, but most of our clients who have, lifelong disabilities, their guardian would be a long-term guardian, and they would be looking out or advocating or looking out for the best interest of their client in terms of legal, medical, housing decisions, that sort of thing.
A follow-up, Madam Chair. With China cases, I think that they're appointed. Does it work the same way in this instance?
Similarly, different processes, but in a child need of aid case, typically the state will remove the child and then start the court process with the guardianship. You would have a petitioner. It could be a family member, a friend, a co-worker who believes that the individual subject to the petition is not able to care for themselves, and they could file a petition with the probate court, and then that starts the process. So they're similar. You have to go to court and start a process with a petition. But different set of laws
and different ones. Okay. Thanks, Josh. Madam Chair, I have one more question. I don't know who. I think Jim could probably answer it best.
Representative, go ahead.
Thank you. In Section 7, in the sectional analysis, it talks about deleting the requirement for the guardian to request that a visitor be appointed, and it requires a court to appoint a visitor. What does that mean, visitor, in this instance? I'm just unfamiliar with the terminology.
One moment, Madam Chair. Jim is reviewing the sexual analysis.
Oh, actually, I was talking to Jim Schein. My apologies. And somebody here, Josh, can answer the question.
Was that a visitor would be appointed to do a report reviewing the guardianship each 3 years. The guardian has to do a report every 3 years, or every year. And then every 3 years, the statutes call for a visitor to do a report, going back and looking at those 2 years. And that clarifies this, because it just says in the body of the language, it says by report, it's clarified.
I guess I just don't know what visitor means. I've never heard it in that context.
Okay. Visitor is investigative.
Okay.
For the purposes of this bill. That's what a visitor does. When a petition is filed, the court appoints an attorney for the person that the guardianship petition has been filed for. That they appoint a visitor, and the attorney designates some sort of expert for the issue of incapacity. The visitor goes out and provides notice to the person. They talk to the petitioner, they talk to the person, they talk to the doctor, they talk to the relatives, they go to the bank. They put together a report for the judge prior to an initial guardian being appointed. And then the statutes call for a visitor to be appointed every 3 years to review the guardianship for the court. And this just clarifies that a visitor does it every 3 years, not every year.
Thank you. Okay. Is Jim Parker wanting to testify, or is he there for questions?
I'm available for questions. I work with Office of Public Advocacy as an attorney in the public guardian section, and I was also involved as I'm a member of the project involved in drafting legislation. Office of Public Advocacy is the agency of last resort. We're supposed to act as guardian and conservative for persons only when there's not a private option available or when there's not a family member. But we have an interest in making sure that people under guardianship and conservatorship are protected, and that thing that has been alluded to that occurred a couple of years ago where a private organization went bankrupt, leaving a lot of people in bad shape, but that doesn't happen again. I think that the station crafting a balance and not making it too difficult and onerous for people who want to act business of providing guardianship and conservatorship services, and we think it's important that that occur and that there be more private options. Part of it is because we cannot absorb all the cases, but it's also because there's a real need out there. So I think we have come up with a good balance. Difficult, but also come up with legislation and statutory provisions that protect vulnerable Alaska. And I am available for questions if anybody
has them. Okay, thank you. I don't see any questions. We'll go on to B. Jarvie from Fairbanks.
Professional guardians or private guardians, however the case may be. I am
I think that's a good idea for everyone. However, I think the guardians that are in the state office of the Office of Public Advocacy should meet the same criteria. I think that court visitors should have criteria set on them. If we, whether it's the OPA guardians or people like myself, have certain certifications and standards to meet, I think court visitors need to have the same standards imposed on them with regard to professional liability, with regard to criteria to be met to enable them to evaluate the work that I have to provide to a certain standard. I do not know that there is any criteria out there for court visitors, but I do believe that the criminal checks, the background checks, professional liability should also apply to all the Office of Public Advocacy contractees or however you want to call them, their contractors, and the court visitor services that provide those services and their employees. I think criminal background checks should be held there too. At the present time, I'm faced with the problem of having my fees set, and they are based on what OPA charges, which is $40 an hour, as opposed to what it actually costs them to provide the service. I'm not even allowed, and I cannot compete with that and still meet my overhead costs. We have so many standards that we have to meet, and I don't mind meeting them. I have consistently stated to anybody with whom I've discussed this that I will meet any and all criteria provided that I have a level playing field and the same criteria applies to everyone else. Now, I know, for instance, there's a lot of conflict between the Office of Public Advocacy and private guardians because they have the option of regulating us and that somebody has to regulate this industry. I realize that. But by far here, locally, the complaints that we get are against the Office of Public Advocacy as opposed to any private agency, even though CAPA or the other agency did go bankrupt. The complaints against the Office of Public Advocacy are far more numerous, and it's because there's no one regulating them. As a matter of fact, they regulate the private industry, but there's no one checking on them because the conservatorship services that they provide are not subject to their own court visitor scrutiny. There's a lot of that type of thing going on. So to say that there is a perception of lack of faith to the private professional industry, if there is one, it has been created by the fact that the playing field is so rugged and it's so nasty for private organizations, and it is created by the Office of Public Advocacy itself. Alaska statutes, it's true, have been described as the best statutes as far as, if not the best, I think I heard it as the second best set of statutes out there offering the most protection for vulnerable individuals. It is their administration, however, which is looked at in many states with askance because we have the agency actively regulating and competing with private professional guardians. I just say, you know, if this criteria is going to be imposed on professional guardians, and I don't object to it being done, this is a vulnerable industry. We do have to have protection. We do have to have regulation. But I want the same criteria to be imposed on my biggest competitor, which is the Office of Public Advocacy. I want the same types of restrictions placed on them. I'm willing to meet them. I think they should, too, if they're going to be regulating me. And, you know, if you want to deal with specifics, I would be very happy to deal with them. But at this point, all I'm asking is that whatever restrictions are imposed here need to be imposed across the board. Professional liability insurance, bondability, that's no problem. It should be required of all OPA contractors. Criminal checks should be required of all court visitor agencies, contractor attorneys, whatever contractors you hire along with their employees. And I'm sorry, I'm coming down with a sore throat, so my voice is kind of getting out of me. And I think the criteria should be imposed on court visitors. you had, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of them, but I think I would be taking up too much time, and I'm afraid my voice would give up by then. And so I am saying that this bill appears to me to have been, and I'm not being, I don't know how to put this without sounding as if I'm being confrontational. I'm not. But it seems to me that this is a very self-serving bill directed to increase the perpetuity of staffing and the role of the Office of Public Advocacy, which statutorily is not compliant. As a matter of fact, they are under statute required to look for and explore the possibility of alternate guardians and conservators. This is not happening, and it can't happen as long as the private professional guardians are excluded from access to the cases. And this happens all the time. I mean, as I told you, I can't even get into court. The other thing that's not the Office of Public Advocacy's fault, I realize that, and I understand staff constraints, but we have no choices as a professional organization. We don't have a choice. We don't have a choice of an attorney to represent the respondent. I have been forced many, many times to have a respondent nominate me, go to court, have the Office of Public Advocacy attorney there,